We're going to talk about yeast.
Yeast?
Today. Yeah. Mark chapter 8, still, verses 14 through 21. Jesus warns about yeast. Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" They said to him, 12. "And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?" So what is going on? What do you think is going on?
Plenty of leftovers?
there's plenty of leftovers. But,
He said something, we've read something about the leaven in your bread before a long time back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see that probably he's going to say that you got to watch out for something else rising your bread for you.
Okay. So, in chapter 8, Jesus had been on the eastern shore, fed the 4,000, got into the boat, went to the western shore, where he was questioned by the Pharisees, and then he got back into the boat, and now they're going back across. They're on the way to the eastern side. So they're on the water. And they had forgotten to bring bread, except for one loaf. So this isn't immediately after the feeding of the 4,000, so okay, it kind of makes sense in the very literal sense that they may not have had
bread. In other words, bread. The leftovers weren't still sitting.
The leftovers weren't still seeing the boat.
Okay.
No.
Now, they don't realize that they only have one loaf until Jesus says to them, after getting into the boat, after being questioned by the Pharisees, after Jesus had been questioned by the Pharisees, so the previous section said the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him, and he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." And he left them, got into the boat again, and went to the other side. Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And now it's at this point that this Jesus talking about leaven or yeast reminds the disciples that, oh, we had forgotten to bring provisions.
Oops.
And so they began to discuss with one another. Or maybe it's more of, I'd say, arguing with one another.
Because
well, it was your responsibility.
And he wants to know why any of it matters to them, because
So, the disciples take Jesus' statement very literally, that he is literally talking about bread.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
He's not.
And Jesus asks, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? And do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened?" And so forth and so on. A whole bunch of questions. So what is this? What is Jesus warning disciples about? What is this warning about? This leaven or yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod. What do they? These two groups have in common?
They're the world outside of what they're teaching. It's tempting to take their ways of thinking and their ideologies and their worldliness is an analogy that I can come up with against their faith in Christ and their ability to see and perceive Christ the way He wants them to see Him.
Where was the previous time in Mark's Gospel that we saw mention of Herod?
Can't remember.
Mm-mm. It was with reference to John the Baptist.
Herod said that That's Christ right. was just the John the Baptist coming back.
Right, right. Okay.
So this whole...
I wouldn't think yeast would be related to murder or whatever.
No, but what he's getting at is that Christ is saying that, see, you add yeast to bread to make it rise, to make it more than it started. Otherwise, it's flat and dense, and it's not as... doesn't break as much. So the yeast of Herod and the yeast of the Pharisees is their influence in the faith of the church that Christ is trying to create with His disciples. So if they build their bread with yeast from those things, their ideas are different.
Yeast is both good and bad in the Gospels, in Jesus' parables. Isn't it?
Well, yeah, there's a time when Jesus uses yeast in to represent something that is good. But in both cases, whether it's representing good or bad, there's this action of the yeast that it's referring to.
Is it talking about how it gets in the whole thing, how it makes it more than it is?
It multiplies.
It multiplies.
You don't see it. No, you don't see it working, but you see its results. It refers to... So Jesus is saying, warning his disciples about something about the influences that both Herod and the Herodians have, and what the Pharisees and the scribes represent.
Because in both instances, the Pharisees are asking Christ for a definition and a point in which He actually exists, or where He came from, or what He's about. And then Herod is dismissing Christ and giving Him His place as He sees it. So He's set it as it is.
Yeah, so here, one of the commentaries interprets this leaven or yeast to mean the corrupting tendency to make Jesus fit into one's pre-existing categories.
Okay.
The Pharisees want a legitimating sign. Jesus' family diagnoses him as a mental case.
Mm-hmm.
The scribes from Jerusalem have him pigeonholed as a demon-possessed magician.
Mm-hmm.
Herod knows that he has to be John the Baptist come back to haunt his executioner. Those who are certain that they know in the air quotes, or scare quotes, who Jesus is, are inevitably misguided. That the disciples need this warning will become evident later in chapter 8, verses 32 and 33. In the boat scene, what we're reading right now, however, the focus is not on what they know, but on what they do not know.
So I have to ask, with all of these New Testament scriptures or books from the different writers, does the normal church read these in the understanding, like, that the disciples knew all of this and were... Because I kind of get the idea that when people talk about Jesus and his disciples, they talk about the disciples like they were... They understood Jesus and they followed him higher than we do, and they weren't more or less almost a... Like, what I'm seeing more is they're more of an analogy of what our church struggles with and what we need to think about and how we need to think about Christ. But the average depiction of the disciples from the churches that...
It depends on the gospel. In Mark, the disciples are depicted as particularly stupid and ignorant.
Okay.
The perception I get from Christian culture... the way I see their depiction of the disciples is that during the time they were with Jesus, they were clueless at times, but gradually growing. And then after Jesus went back to heaven and they received the Holy Spirit, then they were basically, they had it. They understood everything.
Okay.
And what they said and did at that point was from God at all times.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I do see the disciples being pictured as kind of clueless at times.
Cool.
In greater Christian culture. Yeah. So... The yeast,
what else is happening here is that, notice that Jesus asks, do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes do you not see, and having ears do you not hear? This is going to connect to a story that follows pretty soon, where Jesus heals someone who is blind, or mm-hmm. someone who is deaf.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it was one of Paul's letters, or I think it was maybe one of Paul's letters where he used the term leaven and hearts hardened, almost a verbatim of the way it's being said here. I don't remember where it was, but I do remember us in a lesson learning about the leavening of something and a heart being hardened against it, almost uh-huh. verbatim of this. I think it was in one of Paul's letters.
Okay.
Or it was in...
So another commentary here reads, both the Pharisees and Herod appear in Mark as representatives of a spiritual blindness that goes beyond rejecting the light into hating it.
Hmm.
It is no doubt this kind of attitude and action that Mark had in mind in writing these words about the yeast the disciples were to avoid. So again, these opponents of Jesus have these preconceived ideas about what Jesus or what a prophet or what a Messiah should fit into. And Jesus refuses to fit into it. And so they persist in trying to fit Jesus into a category, and Jesus persistently refusing, their hearts become hardened.
Mm-hmm.
They become more blind. They become more deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And the end of the gospel account is going to show the result of that kind of persistence.
So why does he portray it as yeast? Is it because it's so pervasive
it's
in the society?
So pervasive, or
it's
maybe
in
it
everything.
Also that you don't recognize it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You let it continue to grow and fester.
The assumptions that society is basically based on
mm-hmm.
that require Jesus to be a certain way, fit into a certain mold, And that's what their society is about. And nobody questions it.
Yeah, you know, Mark probably didn't have the psychological understanding that we do, but when it has to do with what we know today as confirmation bias. You know, when the Pharisees reject Jesus the first time, then they have to find ways to justify their rejection. Right. And in so doing, they begin this path from which there it is very difficult to return.
In order to return, you would have to deny...
You would have to admit that your initial judgment was wrong.
And however long you'd been judging that,
and you've made all these judgments based on that initial one,
mm-hmm.
piled one on top of another, and to go back on it means to deny all of the judgments that you have made.
Yeah, I don't think the yeast thing has so much to do with the way their society worked or anything, or how it works into society. I think it's really literally just a consumable analogy by the entirety of the people that are reading it, because yeast's scientific reaction at that time was one of the most known reactions to create mm-hmm. the analogy that he's trying to show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, otherwise in society you'd have to say it's like the Facebook of watch out for their Facebook, you know, it would be, or their news channel or something like that. It's one of the most literal forms of analogy that would dictate to the people reading this or understanding it.
It makes sense to a lot of mm-hmm. people.
Right.
It still makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the disciples don't get it.
Of course they don't. We have a hard time getting it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, as far as Jesus is concerned, the disciples are on the same path as the Pharisees, as Herod, as Jesus' family.
They keep trying to put Jesus in a recognizable box. They keep trying to say, which box are you in? And he's trying to get out of the box. And they can't handle the lack of definition.
So here, commentary reads, the audience comes to the chilling realization that indeed the disciples are deaf and blind. Indeed, their hearts are hardened. Worse yet, these are characteristics of those outside. The scene poses a serious threat to an audience that has been led to identify with the disciples as followers of Jesus and recipients of the mystery of the reign of God. The long tradition of the mystery religions and their revival during the Hellenistic period had produced a high level of confidence in the efficacy of initiation. To be one of those to whom the mystery has been given was to be transformed from a mere mortal into a true spiritual insider. This revelation that the disciples are blind, deaf, and hard of heart, despite their insider status, shatters the complacency of the audience of this gospel. If the disciples, recipients of the mystery and chosen companions of Jesus, are to be counted among the outsiders, who is left on the inside? And how can one be sure of remaining inside when the boundaries seem so fluid?
But that's what the society was built on, is this structured, if I give you this, you'll redeem me, or if I have my soul set right by these priests, everything's okay. So everything had to do, all gods in that time had to deal with, or were dealt with by their patrons a certain way. Like, they had to fit something. Otherwise, they wouldn't get what they were asking for.
Yeah. So Mark's gospel is probably written a few decades after the events of these that take place. Mm-hmm. It's being written to a Christian audience who believe that they are insiders. And Mark includes this as a warning that just because you think you're on the inside doesn't make you actually an insider.
Yeah.
You're counting on being one of the inside ones. Your life assumptions are based on the idea that you are. You yourself are the definition of on the inside. And you don't got it.
So that goes back to the whole problem that people in Christian communities as a whole have with their doctrines is they're trying to depict a form of insidership. How mm-hmm. are we supposed to fit into this relationship mm-hmm. that we're all supposed to have with Christ?
So, you know, what do these stories reveal about what Mark is trying to communicate about who is on the inside? You know, who belongs in this family of Jesus?
I think that's what we're all still very confused about. I mean, honestly, I can't say that I have, like, an answer to that question that I feel is solid. Because I don't exactly know at this point what, especially the more we read, how I'm supposed to exactly fit in.
Yeah, because especially in this unit from about Mark chapter 6 through the end of chapter 8, you know, Jesus is breaking boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He is breaking the boundaries of what people believe traditionally were the people of God.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus is saying, no, you think you're inside, but you're really outside, but those that you thought were outside, they're the ones inside.
Yeah, I mean, it's a joke of ours as fishermen when somebody asks where we caught that fish. We say it's on the inner edge of the outer reef, inner banks, you know, and so it's a joke, kind of, but it's
uh-huh.
a very poor joke in this situation because we kind of, in this day, still...
Christianity
when you're delving into it a little bit, you're trying to find between doctrine and faith and a place to be what is the actual road or even parallel to the relationship with Christ that you're supposed to have. And like I say,
Christianity is still based on being on the inside and the knowledge that I am saved and I've got it and I'm on the inside. So now I need to talk to the people who are on the outside and convince them to come in. And Jesus here is saying, you think you're on the inside, but sorry, you don't got it.
That makes me want to shut up and hear what the rest of Mark is saying then, because I'm not saying to at least to shut up. I meant that now I'm eagerly awaiting what is coming then, because I feel like hopefully there's something in the end.
Hopefully there's something in the end.
Well, you know, I think it's maybe part of it is meant to raise questions. Modern Christianity, anyway, tends to want to give answers.
I see.
And we want to hear answers.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like to live in the space of ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so far in Mark, what we're seeing is, you know, kind of this whole idea of being inside and outside is ambiguous.
It mirrors a lot of what we have today. Today we have a scientific definition of an exacting point of reference for what we believe to be true of this or that opinion that we have. We've gone through what we have found that science is more of an opinion-based structure of fact than it is sometimes actual fact-based knowledge. But in the end-all, be-all, these people of this time had the exact same thing going with their structured levels of religious belief being obtained through their practiced religious beliefs. So if they needed this level of belief or this level of redemption, they were able to get it through these specific forms of ritual. And what Christ is doing is he's making these people have to basically live on the fact that maybe they're okay. Their faith, their idea in their own heart that they're okay. And that's kind of what we're being asked to do in the same regard nowadays, where we have this strictly finite ability to know exactly where we're supposed to be in the world right now. And we're being told, well, you kind of got to go on.
Maybe it's okay to not have answers all the time.
Yeah, which is...
And we need to be satisfied with not having answers.
So it's really not much different, if you think about it in that regard, of our science somewhat being our... It holds a lot of our faith. A lot of our faith is held in science because we believe we have an answer for these questions.
Yeah. I think it's maybe instructive to look at both the feeding of the 5,000 and feeding of the 4,000. The feeding of the 5,000, Jesus showed compassion when the disciples came to him and tried to make Jesus send the crowd away. Jesus said to the disciples, "You feed them." In feeding of the 4,000, Jesus showed compassion by telling the disciples to, well, how much?
Feed them.
What do you have? Feed them. So maybe part of being in the family of Jesus is to have that kind of compassion. It's more than simply knowing about Jesus, but it is doing the works that Jesus did. So, who do we show compassion to? Who do we feel compassion for? No, it's easy to feel compassion for those people who we think deserve it.
Yeah, or the directly next to us or around us.
But what about our enemies? I mean, what about, you know, our literal enemies?
That's very hard. Or the people that we look at and say, that person hasn't earned the right to my compassion.
Yeah. And it's hard to be compassionate to someone that has no compassion. When you see that they're not compassionate at all, you don't want to waste your time on them. It's hard.
I've had a lot of people in my life that do... Like, as far as compassion's concerned, like, I guess I ride a little bit more on the totalitarianistic, like, yeah, you haven't earned it type, because I've met a lot of people in my time that are so destructive in their own nature, and toward you, and toward the individuals that want to help them, that there is no helping that person in the standard form of help. The only compassion that you can give them that gains any part of a compassionate presence in the world is to not condemn them, pray for them to become a better person, and not hold a grudge, but to simply let that person go and be the way they need to be until they want to come and receive compassion in a further regard.
Sometimes
that's impossible. So that's a tough one for me to say.
Compassion is not the same as fixing problems.
That's where I was going with that, because you can't, you cannot.
Sometimes you can't.
You can't fix even nice people. I mean, sometimes people are so nice that if they're being too much, you can't. It's hard to tell them to stop. So it's important to remember that
sometimes there's situations where you can truly help
it. Yeah, absolutely. If somebody's cold, you can make them warm. If somebody needs food, you can feed them.
So much more.
You can assuredly take care of the basic necessities of human existence. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the mental well-being of people who have those needs met, that's when the real work...
That's when it becomes really hard.
Well, that's when the definitions of helping somebody, of compassion for people, get extremely blurred.
Really hard to define.
Yeah, that's, you know, I mean, physical needs are very easily met in a compassion society. Although not, because we haven't seemed to be able to feed the entire world yet, or house them, or keep them warm, but nonetheless...
Well, that's not because we don't have resources.
Right. Right. But that's, I mean, even there, you are kind of tipping on a part of what Christ is talking about with it. You know, you could dicker with the emotional needs of people, but we still have yet to actually meet the needs of life itself in our planet with the work of Christ anyway, so, or the compassion, I guess you should say. But as far as my life's concerned, when it comes to compassion for people, that's one where I kind of have a really hard time as far as what I'm supposed to do, and I feel sometimes a little bit like maybe I'm writing things off, but I've just come to the realization, and, or at least for me, I've said to myself, because I have no other answer, that I think those individuals in particular that are unrelenting in their desire to hurt those individuals around them that do want to help, I think they're just better left as I hope you get better and I will pray for you. And that's all I can do as far as that's concerned.
So that's the end of the text. Here are a few more quotes from Feasting on the Gospels, the Gospel of Mark, commentary. The inclusive nature of the good news of Mark chapter 8 gives us reason to ponder, who are we being called to include, whom we might otherwise exclude? What are we being called to share in our community and society so that all may be fed? Given today's economic realities, many of our congregants hold a scarcity mindset. In other words, since we have only a few little fish and seven loaves, read a dwindling endowment, an aging membership, a changing neighborhood, we really cannot address the enormous needs around us. What are the resources your hearers have at hand, no matter how meager they perceive them to be? Could adopting a grateful attitude of abundance produce leftovers, so to speak? It is significant that between two mass feedings of chapters 6 and 8, a nameless Syrophoenician woman reminds us, as she contends with Jesus, that even the dogs who are not at the table, meaning the marginalized, the poor, those others, eat the crumbs of the meal served to the family. The yeast of the Pharisees is the insatiable need to defend their influence, a need that they and all religious authorities seem to have. Those who are in control of religious truths will always defend their position. Their threatened stance is revealed in their demand for more proof of Jesus' authority. Now Jesus warns his disciples, beware of the endless thirst for maintaining your religious position. If you spend your lives defending what you think you know, you will overlook the signs of God's life-giving presence right in front of you. The yeast of these Herodians and their modern counterparts is the insatiable desire for power. Now Jesus warns his followers, beware of the addictive lust for authority. If you spend your lives defending the power you believe you have, you will abdicate real authority to popular opinion. And consider these Pharisees. They want to test Jesus, which means that they want Jesus to fit within their preconceived notions of what the Messiah must look like and act like. So another way of looking at the yeast of the Pharisees is their insatiable need and desire to defend their authority. The east of the Herodians is their insatiable desire for power. Power and authority. And it's interesting that in the end, Jesus' crucifixion comes as a result of both of these things coming together. Mm-hmm. Jesus threatens both. He threatens religious authority and he threatens power.
I still think it odd that he says, "Beware the yeast of the Pharisees," and he doesn't explain what he's talking about. He's beware of something about the Pharisees, basically, he's saying.
Something.
Yeah. Beware of the something of
Can't
the Pharisees.
Can't you just say it?
Actually, that one was oddly apparent to me.
Yeah. It just seems odd to me that he never explained what he was talking about.
In fact, I always struggle exactly with what Mark is talking about, what you're supposed to do with it. Because I look at it like, okay, well...
literal answer.
Well, I look at it like, okay, Christ literally is against power and authority, and that's mm-hmm. the only reason why, flat out, we still live the way we do right now. Mm-hmm. It's because people are unwilling to relinquish mm-hmm. their ability to control...
Mm-hmm. And everyone else around them.
Yeah, even in completely microcosm, minute little environments of the family home where parents or kids or whatever can't
power
relinquish...
Struggles.
Yeah, power struggles. All the way down to that. They're everywhere. And, mm-hmm. and anyway, I interrupted Mark, so I... Well, hear what you had to say.
Sorry. That's the end.
Mm-hmm. No, but I meant you were going to say something and I interrupted you.
I don't recall now.
Okay. Darn.
That's interesting.
Oh, now I know what I was going to say. Jesus frequently left his hearers with questions. Mm-hmm. He didn't explain.
My mom used to say, "For me to know and you to find out."
For you to figure it out later.
For me to know and you to find out.
Oh my!
What would we have done with his answers that if he would have answered anyway? It would be, I don't know. Wouldn't.
Well, I think the problem is answers are often specific to that time, that precise situation. But questions are broader.
Mm-hmm. And something like the yeast, well, different people can interpret that differently, maybe. Huh. Weird, yeah.
See, I think about that a lot because, like, in our daily life, like as Americans anyway, we, you know, everybody takes this Sunday as kind of like a, even myself, as kind of like a forced stop your little bubble, you know, and then, mm-hmm. and then we even, like, our work ethics, our lifestyles, and our job environments. Our job environment beyond ourselves is an empiristic attitude of consume and control and gain as much as possible. So these times that people are saying that you need to, like a church group, mm-hmm. we need to do something with our meager means. The meagerest means that all of us have to us, and I don't care how affluent you are, is time. Because in order for us to conduct and control our environment the way we would approve and enjoy having our time, that's the one that we're all missing the ability to give up as much as it needs to for us to have that much influence with the people around us. So I get somebody all the time saying, "Well, you just don't like people." Like, no, not necessarily. I really love people, like, but I just don't really have a lot of time for them. So, and that's my honest.
Yeah,
like,
a saying along those lines, though. I'm not antisocial. I'm just selectively social.
Yeah. Well, see, but that's what's wrong is that not only if we decided as a human or as an American to give more compassion and more of our time to the people around us, it's still a little bit impossible with how stuffed we've made our schedules for what we want to be in the world that we're in now. I mean, one hobby on top of your daily existence for what you have to do as a, say, middle-aged person to conduct a household, earn a wage, and live at a certain level of lifestyle that you want to live at is more than you actually have time-wise to enjoy even that part of something you'd like to be doing. So now you got to divide up that hobby time to other people time or family time. You know what I mean? You have all these little brackets that you have to divide those up into. And now if you're talking on a corporate level, well, now you got to stop making money long enough to do this. And how do I choreograph, you know, 5,000 workers to helping do something? And am I going to pay them for their time? It's time. It really is time that people need to learn how to give to other people. Which is pretty sobering for me to say because I'm worse at it. I don't multitask well.